23, we need to finish our study of that portion of the book of Exodus that came to be called the Book of the Covenant. Now, the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments, are found in chapter 20 of Exodus, and then chapters 21, 22, and 23 are a set of statutes and ordinances and laws that came to be called, as a body of legislation, it came to be called the Book of the Covenant. And it came to have special relevance. It was sort of an expanded commentary on the Ten Commandments. We saw, as we've already been through chapters 21 and 22, that it dealt with a number of issues on God's mind. Some of them were human rights issues, dealing with the rights of slaves and women. And while we object to the concept altogether of slavery, or to some of the ways that women were generally viewed and treated in those days, yet for the time and for the region and for the point of philosophical development that the society had reached at that time, the laws of Moses present probably the loftiest view of human rights to be found anywhere. That is to say, the slaves were treated not like chattel. They were understood to be a man's property because he had purchased them, but they were still human and needed to be considered human and treated like humans. And the same with women, though that was not the custom of the societies around the Jews at this time, nor of them themselves, until he gave the law. We find God's concern for the sanctity of life and that murderers would be put to death. Even a person who had indirectly killed someone by neglect and leaving a dangerous animal running loose. If a person was killed by this animal, the owner would be penalized for it. There's expanded treatment of the law about honoring your father and mother. A man who smites or curses his parents would be put to death. In general, chapters 21, 22, and the first nine verses of 23 speak of man's obligations with respect to his relationship to other men. Where the remainder of chapter 23, after verse 9, mainly deals with man's obligation religiously to God. One of the main themes, I suppose, that we find in Exodus chapters 22 and 23 is justice and impartiality, and how the Jews were not supposed to afflict those who were vulnerable, the widows and the orphans, or the strangers who were aliens in their land, or the slaves, or women, or anyone else. They were supposed to show justice and extend equal rights, or let's not say equal rights, since the slaves didn't have equal rights, but let's just say basic human rights were extended to all people, and all injustice was frowned upon and condemned. Now, in chapter 23, verses 1 through 9, the same is true. The general theme of these nine verses seems to be impartiality in justice, not showing partiality in favor of one of your countrymen as opposed to a stranger or an alien, and not showing favoritism toward the poor or toward the rich, but just being equal and just in all your dealings and all your decisions. It says, "Thou shalt not raise a false report, put not thine hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Neither shalt thou speak in the cause to decline after many to rest or pervert judgment. Neither shalt thou countenance a poor man in his cause. If thou meet thine enemy's ox or his ass going astray, thou shalt surely bring it back to him again. If thou see the ass of him that hateth thee lying under his burden, and wouldest forbear to help him, thou shalt surely help with him. Thou shalt not rest or pervert judgment of the poor in his cause. Keep thee far from a false matter. And the innocent and righteous slay thou not, for I will not justify the wicked. And thou shalt take no gift," that means bribe, "for the bribe blindeth the wise, and perverteth the words of the righteous. Also thou shalt not oppress a stranger or foreigner, for ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing you were strangers in the land of Egypt." There are several classes of people that a person might be inclined to favor or disfavor simply because of the category they fall into. And he's saying, do not observe those categories and do not twist justice or mercy, for that matter, in favor or against any particular class. For example, he says at the beginning, you shall never raise a false witness against anyone in court. Later on, the law specified that if a man bore false witness against his neighbor and was caught in the act of doing so, that whatever penalty the false witness expected his neighbor to receive, he would receive. So if it was like in a capital crime, if a man falsely accused another man of doing something worthy of death, the false witness would be put to death if he was caught in the act. If it were a matter of, some other penalty that was intended for the innocent, then the false witness would receive that penalty himself. This was later an elaboration of this verse in verse 1. In verse 2, where it says, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil, neither shalt thou speak in a cause to decline after many to pervert justice. Basically, it's saying don't be swayed by the crowd. It may be that everyone else is raising false witnesses. It may be that everyone else is twisting judgment, but don't run with the crowd. You need to stand out even if you're the only person. Don't decline after many. That means don't descend or don't give in or acquiesce to the will of the crowd or to the multitude if it happens to be wrong what they're doing. And you need to stand up for righteousness even if you're the only one doing so. Then, of course, it mentions, you shall not countenance a poor man in his cause. Now, this is not to say that you shouldn't show compassion to the poor, but it means that you shouldn't twist justice on behalf of the poor. Later on, it says just the opposite, not in contradiction, but in balance. It says in verse 6, thou shalt not wrest the judgment of thy poor in his cause, which means you shall not afflict or deprive the poor of justice. In other words, when it comes to a situation where the judges have to make a decision and one of the persons in the conflict is a poor person, the judge shall not decide against the poor person just because he's poor. And he shouldn't decide in favor of the poor person just because he's poor. He should not let that enter into his thinking, whether a man's poor or not. He should let enter into his thinking what is the just decision, and that justice needs to be exercised without regard for a man's financial or economic state. Even your enemy you are to show mercy to and be just to. In verses 4 and 5, if you find that your enemy has suffered some misfortune, his animal has escaped or his animal has fallen under its burden, you, even though you would rather forbear, that means you'd rather do nothing about it, yet you are obligated to do the same thing for your enemy that you do for your friend. If you saw your friend's animal in such a condition, you would step in to bring aid, and so shall you do if it's your enemy. You're not supposed to show partiality in favor of friends and against your personal enemies. In other words, what Jesus said about you shall love your enemy did not originate from Jesus only. He was bringing out the essence of what God even said through Moses. Then, of course, it says in verse 7, keep far from a false matter, and the innocent and the righteous do not slay, for I will not justify the wicked. Now, he's saying essentially that you might condemn a righteous man in court, but you yourself will be condemned in God's court if you're wickedly doing that. And, of course, he says in verse 9 what he had already said earlier, that you shall be compassionate to those who are aliens living in your land, because you were once in that same condition in Egypt, and you ought to know what it feels like. You know the heart of a stranger. Now he goes into some Sabbath laws, Sabbath days and Sabbath years. We have already seen the Sabbath law, the fourth commandment in the Decalogue, but now he points out not only that are they to observe Sabbath days, one out of every 7 days, but also Sabbath years. One out of every 7 years they're supposed to let their land rest. This, of course, was for the soil to replenish itself, but it was also for the sake of the poor. In fact, the reference to the Sabbath in these following verses seems to be more concerned about how this affects the poor and the working man than as far as religiousness of the day. Because the Sabbath day basically required that all men rest, including the servants. You see, if there was no such law as this, a wealthy plantation owner might keep his slaves working 7 days a week and they'd never get any rest. But God says, nope, enforced rest, 1 day a week. Everyone, even the slaves, have to rest. And so this is to the benefit of the working man, especially the slave, and there were many slaves in that society. He could not be forced to work his brains out. You know, he had to get, he was entitled to at least one day of rest per week. Furthermore, when the land was to rest for a year out of every seven, that was in order that the poor might just kind of live off whatever grows out of the ground. They were not supposed to sow the seeds in their ground that seventh year. But there would still, of course, be seeds that had fallen from the previous harvest and so forth that would spring up. And whatever sprang up was just for the poor people to eat. So, again, the keeping of Sabbaths is seen to have some social justice behind it. It's not just a religious ordinance. It's a matter of looking out for the welfare of the working class and the poor. And it says in verse 10, "In 6 years thou shalt sow thy land, and thou shalt gather the fruits thereof. But the seventh year thou shalt let it rest and lie still, that the poor of thy people may eat. And what they leave, the beasts of the field shall eat. In like manner thou shalt deal with thy vineyard and with thy olive yard." So that applies to your wheat fields, to your fruit orchards and so forth, your vineyards. So the poor, you know, the poor could go every 7 years and just collect whatever was growing around the land. Then it says, 6 days shalt thou do thy work, and on the seventh day thou shalt rest. And thine ox and thine ass may rest, that the son of thy handmaid and the stranger may be refreshed. So again, your slaves can be refreshed on this day. And in all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect. The word circumspect has two English roots into it. Circum, we know the word circumference or circumstances. Circum speaks of around. A circumference is the different the distance around something, and circumstances is that which surrounds you. Your circumstances are the actual combination of the events that surround your life and provide your environment at the moment. Spect obviously is related to other words that have that thing in it, like spectacle, or spectator, or inspect. This all has to do with looking. And so when you put the two words together, the word circumspect actually has the meaning or the idea of looking around. And it means, of course, being alert and careful, like a man who's walking in enemy territory, always looking around that no danger befall him, that he doesn't lose his advantage or get overtaken or something like that. And so when this word is used religiously, and it is used in religious context in the scripture several times, it means that we're supposed to be, as Peter said in 1 Peter 5:8, vigilant and sober and looking out, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, seeketh whom he may devour. We're supposed to be always on the lookout for and always alert to avoid the danger of falling into disobedience, into the hands of the devil, actually. So he says, in all these things you shall be circumspect. That means very cautious, very vigilant, looking around, making sure that you don't fall into any pits or be overtaken by your spiritual enemies or fall into disobedience, but very alert and watchful. And make no mention of the name of other gods, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth. Now, some have taken this absolutely literally and felt like we should never even mention other gods. Therefore, even to speak in a matter-of-fact way about the names of the gods of the Greeks or the Romans would be a violation. Those same people who take this very literally think we need to go back to the biblical names for the days of the week, because the days of our week that are commonly used are named after heathen gods. Saturday is after Saturn, and Sunday is after the worship of the sun, and Thursday is after the god Thor, and so forth. So it's evident that if we were really to never mention the names of other gods, we'd have to go back to calling the days of the week like the Bible does: the first day of the week, second day of the week, third day of the week, and so forth. First day being Sunday, the last day being the Sabbath, and so forth, Saturday. Also, the months of the year are named after gods of the heathen. March is named after the god Mars. And many of the others are too. I can't, just my mind draws a blank on some of the other examples. But The point is that the days of our week, the names of our months, many of them have the names of gods in them. I've known of Christians who have published an alternate calendar for Christians that don't use those names. They just number the months and number the days of the week. But I think that's going a little beyond what this is talking about. After all, Baal and Molech, who are heathen gods, are mentioned by name in the scriptures by the inspired writers. They mention the names of the false gods, so it doesn't mean that you cannot ever mention their names in any connection. What this is specifically talking about is that the Jews shall never begin to mention or make use of the names of other gods as they use the name of Jehovah. And particularly, this probably has to do with vows. We don't appreciate the whole concept of vows like they did in those days. One of the major parts of their religious worship was the making of vows to God. And they would vow in the name of Jehovah, which was quite all right for them to do. He was their God. They took His name upon them. And even the command, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain," had probably more to do with vows than any other connection. You shall not make vows in the name of the Lord and not keep them, is what is implied by it. And here, I believe he's saying they should not swear by or use the name of the Lord of other lords, of other gods, in their vows. Because what you do when you're making a vow is you're invoking the virtue of whoever it is whose name you're using. You know, "I swear by God" means that maybe you don't trust me, but you certainly must trust God, and therefore I'm bringing Him, God as my witness, as Paul put it at various times. And that's another way of using the name. Well, you're not supposed to use the names of other gods in vows, which were a highly religious usage. And I think that that's more or less what's involved in this command, rather than just it being wrong to ever utter the name of a false god. So I don't think we need to get too legalistic. Now it talks about the three festivals which the Jews had to keep every year. There were actually more. As far as holy days and festivals, there were actually seven altogether, which are found in the book of Leviticus. We won't go into them now. We will later, and we'll talk about their symbolic meaning also. But there were three festivals every year which the Jews, after they were settled into the Promised Land and when Jerusalem was their capital and the temple was there, they had to go to the temple every year, three times. Every male Jew over 12 years old was required by law to go to the temple three times a year, if it were possible, unless he lived, you know, thousands of miles away and couldn't make it there. And these three festivals are named here, and of course were named later. Now, each of these have different names. That is to say, each festival has alternate names by which it's called. Here they're called the Feast of Unleavened Bread in verse 15, and in verse 16, the Feast of Harvest of the First Fruits. And then also later in verse 16, the third one is the Feast of the Ingathering. Now those have different names that we probably know them better as, and we find different names for these same feasts later in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, of course, is associated with Passover. It begins with the Passover celebration in April, usually it's April, and then extends for 7 days afterward, where the Jews ate no unleavened bread. The next feast, the Feast of Harvest of the First Fruits, is particularly the harvest of the wheat, which was in June. And that is what came to be called Pentecost. And the reason it was called Pentecost is because Pentecost means 50. It's a Greek word for 50 days, and it was 50 days after Passover. So the Feast of the First Fruits was they'd offer the first fruits of their wheat harvest to God 50 days after Passover. And then the third one, the Feast of Ingathering, was where they gathered in their actual fruit harvest, their figs and their olives and their grapes and so forth. That was later in the summer, actually in September sometime, they would gather it up. So for us in the northern hemisphere, which they were also in the northern hemisphere, that meant, of course, sometime in the fall, early fall. And that feast came to be called the Feast of Tabernacles, because it was celebrated by 7 days of camping out in the streets of Jerusalem in little tabernacles, little booths and tents that they'd set up to commemorate their wandering in the wilderness. So these feasts had different ideas associated with them at different times. The Passover was also the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or at least associated with it. It was all 1 week that these things happened. The Feast of the First Fruits, or the Harvest of the First Fruits, was Pentecost. And the Feast of the Ingathering was at the end of summer, early fall, when they gather in the fruit harvest, and that was later called the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, an interesting thing about the feasts of the Jews, and I'll get more into this when we get into Leviticus and see all seven of the festivals. We'll talk about the meaning of each of them, but just if I might say very briefly at this point, it's fascinating to me that Jesus fulfilled the meaning of Passover on the very day that the Jews were celebrating Passover. He was crucified. He became our Passover lamb the very day that the Jews were celebrating Passover themselves. And he fulfilled Passover on the day that they celebrated it. The day of Pentecost, which was the Jews' feast of the first fruits, was 50 days after Passover. And it happens on that particular year when Jesus fulfilled Passover, the very next Pentecost, 50 days later, God received the first fruits of his harvest, of the church. When the Holy Spirit was poured out on the Jews, the Jewish believers in Acts chapter 2, it was on the day of Pentecost. The day of Pentecost was not a Christian holiday, as it is considered to be now. It was a Jewish holiday, and it dates all the way back to the Exodus. And the Jews always celebrated the day of Pentecost 50 days after Passover. It just so happens, Jesus fulfilled both of those. The spiritual meaning of them was fulfilled on the day that they're fulfilled. Just so happens. Well, it's more than coincidental. Now, I might add this. The remaining feast that is not yet fulfilled is the Feast of Tabernacles, which is called the Feast of the Ingathering, where all the fruit is gathered up. Any idea how that might be fulfilled? At the second coming of Christ, I believe, is that when he gathers the fruit of the earth. In Revelation, it's depicted as the harvest of grapes. Two angels are seen putting their sickle in to the earth to harvest the fruit of the earth at the second coming of Christ. And I believe that the second coming will fulfill this, the meaning, the spiritual meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Ingathering. Now, I don't want to set any dates because we don't know what year it is or anything like that, and I'm not even clear what day of the year Feast of Tabernacles is, except I know it's sometime in September. But interestingly, since Jesus fulfilled the spiritual meaning of Passover and Pentecost on the very days on the Jewish calendar when those things were being celebrated, some have felt that we are warranted in suggesting that the second coming of Jesus will be some year during the Feast of Tabernacles, during September. So we don't want to be date setters, and people have made a lot of mistakes in doing that, and some have actually tried to figure out the year and the day and everything like that. But I think that if the pattern that Jesus has already set in fulfilling whatever feast he has fulfilled is to be understood as his policy, then we might expect the ingathering of the church and the second coming of Christ to happen sometime in September, some year. I don't know what year. Yes. What is it? Sukkoth means booths, but I don't know if the same word is associated with the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay. Well, remember Abraham or Jacob lived in a certain place that he called Sukkoth because he built booths for his cattle. And the name Sukkoth means booths. And also the Jews leaving Egypt stopped in another place called Sukkoth. So Feast of Tabernacles, or booths, as it's sometimes called, I guess if in Brooklyn, if the Jews call it Sukkoth, that'd be the same feast, yeah. Be in September sometime. There were two places called Sukkoth, apparently. There was one in Palestine that Jacob camped at, and there was another one in Egypt where the Jews stopped on their way out. Passover. See, that was the Jewish calendar. The Jewish calendar started in the first month, which is Abib. On the 14th day of that month was the Passover. 50 days later was the day of Pentecost. And I might add, I was talking to Trent about this, but not in class, but according to the rabbis and the Jewish tradition, it's not stated in Scripture, but it's a Jewish tradition, the law was given on the first Pentecost. That when Moses went up on the mountain and received the Ten Commandments, that was on the day of Pentecost, 50 days after Passover. Now, what's confusing about that is in Exodus 19, it tells us in verse 1, in the third month, when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. And we get the impression that it was a three-month journey from Egypt to Sinai, and we say, well, that couldn't be 50 days. 3 months is 90 days. But then when you look at it more closely, as Trent and I were a while ago, we realize that we weren't thinking quite right, or I wasn't when I was thinking that way. It says in the third month. It doesn't say at the end of the third month. The first month was Abib, and Passover was in the middle of that month. If you measure 50 days from the middle of Abib, you'd be sometime in the third month. It would include the rest of the first month, the second half, the whole of the second month, and then you'd have a little bit of 4 days or so of the third month would be Pentecost. So it is entirely possible that the Jewish tradition is correct. It's a stubborn tradition. Chapter 19, verse 1 says that they came to Sinai in the third month. It doesn't say whether it was early in the third month or late in the third month, but the point is that it could have been the day of Pentecost. The 50th day after Passover would fall sometime in the third month, since Passover is in the middle of the first month. If you just figure the calendar out, you can see that clearly. So the first Pentecost might have been when the law was given, but it came to be celebrated later as the harvest of the first fruits, because it happened in June when they were harvesting the first fruits of their grain. And of course it came to be called the Feast of the First Fruits or the Feast of Pentecost or variously other things. But the point is that Jesus fulfilled Passover by becoming the Passover on the day of Passover. He fulfilled the Feast of the First Fruits by bringing the first fruits into the church when the Holy Spirit was poured out. And we might feel ourselves safe in assuming that when it's time for the ingathering at the second coming of Christ, that he will do it at the very time of the year that the Jews celebrate the ingathering. We won't speculate too much. There are some other interesting connections, by the way, with the Jewish feasts. I said there are seven altogether, but there were only three in which the Jews were required later to go into Jerusalem and present themselves three times a year before the Lord for these feasts. The other ones they could celebrate at home. But we'll talk about all of them. When the whole seven, the whole Jewish calendar of festivals is looked at as a whole, and we'll put it on the board to show you when we come to it, you'll find that there's an interesting spiritual parallel with the ministry of Christ and the church in the yearly calendar of the Jews. Well, can't get into it right now, of course. But here we have the mention of those festivals. We'll just read what it says there in verse 14. Three times thou shalt keep the feast unto me in the year. Thou shalt keep the feast of the unleavened bread. Thou shalt eat unleavened bread 7 days as I command thee in the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it thou camest out from Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of thy labors, which thou hast sown in the field, and the feast of the ingathering, which is the end of the year, that being September, when thou hast gathered in thy labors out of the field. Three times in the year all thy males shall appear before the Lord. Thou shalt not offer blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread, neither shall the fat of my sacrifice remain until morning. The first of the first fruits of thy land thou shalt bring into the house of the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not see the kid in his mother's milk. Now this last line stands out like a sore thumb in the discussion, and it's not the only time it appears. There's a number of other times in the law where they're told not to seethe a kid in its mother's milk. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21 is one of those places. The meaning of that last statement is highly debatable. In fact, no one knows what the purpose of that command was. It is assumed by most Jewish commentators and rabbis that the seething of a kid in its mother's milk was part of a heathen ritual which the Jews were forbidden to imitate. Not that the milk or the meat or anything had anything to do with it, but just that they were not supposed to imitate the particular practice of the heathen of cooking a baby goat in its own mother's milk. It's most Christian commentators believe that it's just considered to be the epitome of cruelty to take the very milk that was intended to nourish the kid and to use it to cook it in, and that it's just considered to be a real gross abuse of the whole role of motherhood. You know, and that it's just considered to be a real perversion to see the kid in its mother's milk. But these are just guesses. No one really knows why it was forbidden. To this day, devout Jews do not eat milk products and meat in the same meal because of this command. They don't know how to take it, so they just play it safe and they figure they won't eat meat and milk together, thinking that maybe there's some kind of health reason or some maybe symbolic reason why they shouldn't be together. But I won't try to clear it up. I don't know. I've wondered all my life what that means, or why he said, don't see the kid in its mother's milk. It's clear what it means. You don't cook a baby goat in its mother's milk. But why God never tells us. He just gives the command. Now he tells them in verses 20 through 33 what they can expect. They can expect the presence of God with them in their journeys, but because God is present, that carries with it mingled blessings and curses, depending on how they respond to him. Because he's with them, they should fear God and obey his commandments, because if they don't, his presence will bring judgment upon them. However, if they are obedient to him, his presence will guide them and protect them. And that's what he says here. He describes his presence as an angel. But we know already that the pillar of cloud in the previous discussion was called the angel of God's presence. Or the angel looked, you know, God sent his angel before them in a pillar of cloud. Remember, the word angel means specifically a messenger, a contact point. It's not really necessarily a mention of an angelic being so much as just a mention that God is making contact with man through this agency. As a man uses a messenger, so God made contact through this cloud. His presence was in the cloud, and only by extension or by symbolically is it spoken of as an angel. It says, "Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place where I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him." This is simply saying, don't think you can get away with disobedience, because my name is in this angel. Many have felt this angel represents Jesus Christ himself, in whom is the name of God. And meaning, when he says my name is in him, it means he has the authority to use my name and to act in my power. Just like an officer has the right to act in the name of the law, to call upon a higher authority than himself. So this angel of God's presence was able to act in God's place, in his name. "But if thou shalt indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For mine angel shall go before thee and bring thee into the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them and quite break down their images. And ye shall serve Jehovah your God, and he shall bless thy bread and thy water, and I will take sickness away from the midst of thee. There shall be nothing cast there young, nor be barren in the land. The number of thy days will I fulfill." Now, these are tremendous promises God is making to the Jews if they would obey him. He said they'd take sickness away from them. All their enemies would flee before them. Neither their cattle nor their wives would ever miscarry. They'd be totally fruitful. There would be no... They'd live out full, long lives. Basically, what he's saying is that he won't have to bring his curses upon them. They can live a naturally prosperous life if they obey him. But he will interfere with those blessings and cut their lives off and bring judgments upon them if they disobey. He says, "Furthermore, I will send my fear before thee, and I will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come, and I will make all thine enemies turn their backs to thee, and I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite and the Canaanite and the Hittite from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little will I drive them out from before thee until thou be increased and inherit the land." Now this says that the taking of the land of Canaan will be gradual rather than all in 1 year. I believe it took about 6 years, as it turns out, in the book of Joshua for them to conquer the whole land. Now God could have driven all the Canaanites out at one time, but he said basically the land would become desolate and would be given to the wild beasts, because the Jews would not be capable of inhabiting all the cities at once. They had to grow, even though there were quite a large number of them, they nonetheless had to grow and become capable of running these different cities and taking over and populating them. And he said, if I drove them all out, most of the cities would be unpopulated for a while and would just go to seed, and then wild animals would overtake them. So he said, I'm going to give it to you piece by piece. This, I think, we'll see is actually a picture of Christian progress and Christian growth, because entering into Canaan definitely represents a stage in our Christian development. Coming into the promises of God and living in the promised land is a spiritual experience for us as Christians. And in the promised land, when we come into the promises of God, which some teachers have compared to being baptized in the Holy Spirit, because the Jews went through the water coming out of Egypt, were baptized, as it were, into Moses, or as we are into Christ. Then they went through water again to come into the Promised Land. They went through the River Jordan, walked on dry land. Some compare that to a second baptism, the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Whether rightly or wrongly, I can't say, but at any rate, there's a certain point in our walk that corresponds to the coming into the Promised Land. And that is characterized by more spiritual warfare than before. The Jews in the wilderness had a few battles with the Amalekites and a few others, the Moabites and the Ammonites, but in general, they had 40 years of relative peace. Not real peace, because they were wandering all the time, but they didn't really have war going on all the time. But when they came into the Promised Land, it was just almost constant warfare until they finally conquered it all. There was one king after another, 10 cities that had to be overthrown, 10 kings. And that being the case, it was a time of great warfare and conflict, but it was also a time of great victory, because God was giving them victories. There is a place that we come to in our lives where God entrusts us with more spiritual battles. If we're getting more trials than we used to get, that might be considered encouraging. God is trusting us with more battles. God is bringing us more into the promises. And the more trials we have, the more victories we have opportunity to log in our experience. Because without battles, you can't have victories. And God is trying to raise us up to rule with Him ultimately. And He's training us in the field of spiritual warfare during this life to be spiritual rulers and more than conquerors through Christ, who loves us. And so God is giving us a share in the action, really. God is in the process of taking over the world, spreading His gospel, the kingdom, to all the world for a witness to all nations. His kingdom is growing like a great mountain to fill the whole earth, or like a mustard seed sending its branches out to all parts, or like leaven in a lump of dough permeating the whole of human society. That's God's business, but He's giving us a piece of the action. He's letting us have do some of the battles for Him. That's a privilege we've been given. We're being raised up to be conquerors and rulers with Him. Not physical, with physical weapons, as you know, I don't mean that, but in the spiritual realm. But it's not fun doing spiritual warfare, but it's a lot of fun getting the victory. But you can't have victory without warfare. Now, there is that place that Christians come to when they begin to trust God more, that there begin to be more trials, but also more victories. And we shouldn't see an increase in trials as a negative thing. And also, the trials don't all come and get vanquished at one time. There are many areas of our lives that need to be conquered for God. Areas where the Canaanite still rules. You know, we've come out of Egypt, but there are still Hivites and Perizzites and Canaanites and Jebusites, areas in our character that have never been really totally conquered. Habits, both habits of behavior and habits of mind, habits of speech, that clearly belong to the Canaanite and not to the kingdom. They are clearly throwbacks to the old way and not to the new nature. And those are areas that we are in the process of conquering. That's what God is doing in our lives. We're fighting His battles, overcoming former bondages and former enemies. But He doesn't do it all at once. It's a progress from one to another. We fight one battle and gain a certain amount of territory. Then we regroup, we increase in strength, and then He sends us off to another one. It's from glory to glory. And that's what He's saying here. I'm not going to drive all the Canaanites out before you at 1 year. It's going to take several years. I'm going to let you grow to fill the gap. I'm not going to just drive out the enemies and leave a vacuum there. But I'm going to let you grow to fill in the space as you move forward. And so I believe there is a picture here of our own growth in the policy God had of bringing the Jews into their land that way and knocking out their enemies gradually instead of all at once. He says in verse 31, "And I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea even to the Sea of the Philistines." The Sea of the Philistines is the Mediterranean. The Philistines were originally from the island of Crete in the Mediterranean, and they had come by ship over to the mainland of Palestine and had pretty much conquered the coastal lands, so that the Mediterranean Sea could be spoken of as the Sea of the Philistines. And those are boundaries that had already been suggested to Abraham. The boundaries of the land of Israel that God was promising to them was from basically the Jordan River and the Red Sea and the Mediterranean Sea and the various other boundaries he mentions, to the desert. He doesn't actually give real specific boundaries on all four sides in this passage, but in other places he designates what their boundaries will be. Then he says in verse 32, "You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee." Now, he's saying you shall not make any covenant with the Canaanites. Because if you let them live and live among you, their ways will seduce you. The Jews never fully carried out what they were supposed to do, and they never did drive out all the Canaanites. And because they didn't, sure enough, the Canaanite religions, Canaanite gods, Baal, Ashtoreth, Molech, they came back into Jewish life. And they were perverted by them because of the sensuous attraction of this worship. These gods were worshipped, their images were sex organs. The image of Ashtoreth, the wife of Baal, was of a statue of female sex organs. And these gods and goddesses were worshipped in sexual orgies, and some of them by infant sacrifices and so forth. And they were just absolutely perverse, but very appealing to a carnal, fleshly kind of people. And God said, you've got to wipe these out entirely, or else they'll be a snare to you, they'll trap you. Now this is, of course, the way it is in our lives too. When we see some area of the past way of thinking, the past way of behaving that is not consistent with God's way, there's still an area of Canaanite domination in our personality, we can't just say, well, it's really relatively harmless, we can live with that for a while. You've got to utterly remove it. You've got to utterly overcome it and drive it out. Because if you even let it lay dormant in your personality, once you know it's there and that you should get rid of it, if you let it stay, it will seduce you back into the old life altogether. And the experience of the Jews illustrates that tendency. Now in chapter 24, after God has said all these things to Moses, he tells Moses that he wants him to bring Aaron and Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders up to the mountain to have a feast. And this is the way they were going to ratify the covenant. Moses read all these words to the people. The people agreed and said, that's fair enough, we'll keep these laws. Moses did some sacrifices, sprinkled the blood on the people and on the Book of the Covenant to suggest that they were entering into covenant by the shedding of blood. And then there was a covenant feast they had with the 70 elders who represented the leadership, and Aaron and Moses and Aaron's sons. And that's what chapter 24 is about. There's a covenant sacrifice and a covenant feast that are made. It says, "And he said unto Moses, come up unto the Lord, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off." Afar off doesn't mean far off from the mountain. He's actually telling these people to come up on the mountain, but not all the way up to, not up into the cloud, where, you know, the cloud was up at the top of the mountain. They were supposed to come partway up the mountain into the holy mountain to have a sacred feast. "And Moses alone shall come near the Lord, but they shall not come near, neither shall the people go up with him." And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words which the Lord has said we will do." They had already said this when God first called them into covenant in chapter 19. "And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, and rose up early in the morning, and builded an altar under the hill, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel." He apparently built this altar to offer sacrifices and had 12 pillars set up around it to represent the 12 tribes of Israel worshiping there. "And he sent young men of the children of Israel, which offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read it in the audience of the people. And they said, all that the Lord hath said will we do, and be obedient. And Moses took the blood, and he sprinkled it on the people, and said, behold, the blood of the covenant which the Lord hath made with you concerning all these words." So this sprinkling of the people with blood sealed the covenant. It was like now, although they had agreed verbally, now they were technically committed. There had been a covenant cut and sealed with the shedding of blood and the sprinkling. Now the Bible indicates that we have entered covenant with Jesus through the sprinkling of his blood, in 1 Peter chapter 1, there's an interesting handle on them. So, one way or the other, it's mentioning that these people were exceptions. God didn't kill them. He gave them special privilege. They were able to come up on the mountain and see God. Now, we might say, well, but doesn't the Bible say elsewhere, no man has seen God at any time? And the answer to that is, yes, no man has seen God fully disclosed. What these people saw was not an actual image or similitude of God. And the reason we know that is because Moses recalls this incident in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and specifically reminds them that they didn't see an image or a similitude of God. Apparently what they saw, you can turn to Deuteronomy 4, but apparently what they saw was the cloud, the Shekinah glory, and under the cloud, the brightness of God's glory appearing on the ground at like a, what's it say, a sapphire stone? What's that, green? Is it sapphire? What color is it? Blue? Okay, blue. Okay, so...
like the foundation of the Jerusalem?
Well, sapphire stones appear in a number of connections in the Bible, yeah.
And then there's the four layers.
Yeah, there are 12 different precious stones that make up the foundations of the New Jerusalem. Sapphire, I believe, is one of them. Also, there is reference to, I think, sapphire in the vision that Ezekiel had of the throne of God. There are a number of cases where sapphire and emeralds and the colors, sapphire being blue, I guess, emeralds green, where the colors that are seen in association with the manifest glory of God are compared to the colors of precious stones. But in Deuteronomy 4, verse 12, Moses is reminding them of this incident. We could actually read verses 11 and 12. It says, "And you came near and stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the midst of heaven, and the darkness, clouds, and thick darkness. And the Lord spake unto you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the voice of the words, but you saw no similitude, only you heard a voice." Then in verse 15, "Take ye therefore good heed to yourselves, for you saw no manner of similitude on the day that the Lord spoke unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire." So he's basically telling them, don't make any images of God. Learn a lesson from your own experience. God didn't show you an image of himself, so you wouldn't try to make a statue imitating it. You didn't see any similitude of God. So even though it says they saw God, we have to understand this meant they saw the Shekinah. They saw the brightness, the pillar of cloud or the pillar of fire. They saw the bright blue radiance under the foot of the cloud. But that's apparently all they saw. And then we go on, and now we're in Exodus 24:12. "And the Lord said unto Moses, Come up unto me into the mount, and be there. And I will give thee tables of stone, and a law, and commandments, which I have written, that thou mayest teach them." Now God had already thundered the Ten Commandments verbally and audibly from the mountain to all the people's ears, and that's when they said to Moses, "You go talk to God and tell us what he said. We'll listen to you, but don't let God speak to us anymore." They trembled at the Ten Commandments that were thundered out from the cloud to them. And now God was going to engrave those same laws on tables of stone. And he called Moses to come up and receive them into the mountain and to disappear in the cloud on the top of the mountain. So Moses rose up and his minister, which means actually his servant, Joshua. Now Joshua we see here for the first time as a servant of Jehovah, of Moses. Of course he became the servant of Jehovah after Moses, because he became the successor of Moses. When Moses died, Joshua took command. But we see that the first appearance of Joshua is as a servant. The Bible says, Jesus said, if anyone wants to be great in the kingdom, he has to be the servant of all. And so Jesus himself said that he had come to be a servant. He came and took on the form of a servant. And of course he's been highly exalted for that reason, the Bible says in Philippians 2. So if you humble yourself, then God can exalt you. This man Joshua was a servant, nothing more. He was just there to serve. But God, for that purpose, raised him up and made him the successor to his master. Same thing happened to Elisha, who was the servant of Elijah the prophet. The Bible describes Elisha's ministry before Elijah was taken up. It says that Elisha poured water over the hands of Elijah, which means he washed Elijah's hands and his feet like a servant would do. He was just a menial servant to the prophet. But because he was humble and served the prophet well, when Elijah was taken up, a double portion of Elijah's anointing came on Elisha. and he became the successor to his master. So you can see this phenomenon here with Joshua also. So Moses and Joshua went up into the mountain, and he said to the elders, "Tarry ye here for us until we come again unto you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man have any matters to do, let him come to them." Now that turned out to be a misplaced confidence. Understandable enough, however. Aaron and Hur had been his assistants previously in chapter 17 when the Amalekites had attacked the Jews and Moses had to put his hands up all day long and his hands were heavy. Aaron and Hur had been the two men who stood by him and held his hands up and assisted him in the ministry. So it seemed a natural thing for him to say, "Well, while I'm up in the mountain, I don't know how long I'll be. Aaron and Hur, my assistants, you can come to them with any matters." But sadly, while we don't know much about Hur, what he did during this time, yet Aaron proved to be an unworthy assistant. And Aaron's the one who ended up making the golden calf at the people's request. But that's often the case. You never know who you can trust. A person might be a loyal assistant, early on, but not later, like Paul said about some of his people that had forsaken him when he went to his first trial. And Demas had forsaken him, having loved this present world. Though those were co-workers at one time, trusted co-workers, yet later on in their lives they forsook him and were not trustworthy. Sad to say. Just shows that you shouldn't really put your confidence in man, but in God. Even good men can fail. Verse 15, "And Moses went up into the mount, and a cloud covered the mount. And the glory of the Lord abode upon Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And the seventh day he called unto Moses out of the midst of the cloud, and the sight of the glory of the Lord was like the devouring fire on the top of the mount in the eyes of the children of Israel." We can hardly fail to call to mind the statement in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 and 29, which make reference to God being a devouring fire. I think verse 29 is the one that says, "Our God is a consuming fire," Hebrews 12. And that's what Moses saw. The appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain. I think it's 12:29, isn't it? Verse 18 has something about that too. Let me see. Yeah, it's Hebrews 12:29. What is verse 18, however, of the same chapter? There's something there about a blazing fire, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's about the Mount Sinai and the fire that was there, right. And then in verse 29 it says, "Our God is a consuming fire." Okay, so it says in verse 18, this Exodus 24:18, "And Moses went up into the midst of the cloud and gat him into the mount, and Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights." Now, all this time, Joshua was positioned on the mountain somewhere halfway between Moses and the elders where they'd eaten their meal. So Joshua was alone also for 40 days and 40 nights, but he didn't have the satisfaction of seeing and talking with God like Moses did up there. Joshua was just waiting for Moses to come out, waiting for a month and a half up there. Now, we know for a fact that Moses was fasting during that time. Later on, in Deuteronomy chapter 9, Moses mentions that he fasted. He didn't eat or drink during that 40 days. Now, we know that going without food for 40 days is not a miraculous feat. Many people have done so, including Jesus, and it's not described as one of his miracles. Many ordinary men have gone 40 days without food, without dying. But without water, that takes a miracle. And only two men, as far as we know, ever went more than 3 days without water in the Scripture and lived. And that would be Moses on this occasion, and Elijah the prophet on another occasion went apparently 40 days without food or water. That's another story. But the interesting thing about Moses is here, he spent these 40 days fasting without food or water, apparently sustained miraculously by the power of God. He came down with the Ten Commandments, found the Jews worshiping the golden calf, broke the Ten Commandments, and went back up for another 40 days without food or water. So the man was definitely not thinking about his flesh during that period of time. It'd be kind of hard to, if you're standing in the presence of the glory of God, you kind of lose your appetite probably. And, I imagine things like eating become a small matter in your eyes. I mean, there's even other things that we get involved in this life that make us forget our meals. how much more would you forget your meals if you're looking at the blazing glory of God, you know? Well, chapter 25 then is where we get into the subject of the tabernacle, and I'm going to wait until after our break to get into that subject. I hope to take the tabernacle in a topical manner rather than verse by verse. To take it piece by piece is better than verse by verse. And as you know, if you've read, I don't know how many of you have read the rest of the book of Exodus, but you find that from here on, there's about 7 chapters here about the tabernacle describing it. And then later, after chapter 34, you get another 5 chapters describing it. In this case, in these chapters that we're now coming to, we have God describing to Moses how the tabernacle shall be built. In the latter 5 chapters of Exodus, it just describes, and the Jews built it that way, and it gives all the same details. How many sachets, how many sockets, what color they were, and what kind of metal they were in, and what their dimensions were. Everything's just the same. So what we're going to do, of course, is just talk about the tabernacle as a whole without taking these 12 chapters verse by verse, which gets very tedious. If we were making a model of the tabernacle, it would be worth our while to read every detail. But since we're not, and since we are more concerned about the spiritual matters, we'll take it in another way. All right, so we'll take our break at this point and come back at 10:15. Yes, Dwayne?